Support for Radio Boston comes from Hadestown at the Box Center Wang Theater, Broadway's Tony and Grammy-winning Best Musical, an epic celebration of music, togetherness, and hope, raves Forbes. Playing April 23rd through April 28th. Buy your tickets today at boxcenter.org.
From 90.9 WBUR, I'm Tiziana Deering. This is Radio Boston. Today, we remember the legacy of community activist and former city councilor Chuck Turner.
He was a guy who really believed that government should be for everyone and that the most vulnerable should be lifted up. For whatever flaws or mistakes he had as a human, no one can dispute that.
Also today, we take in a whole decade in politics.
This American carnage stops right here and stops right now.
And in tech.
We think we've got something, and we call it the iPad.
We'll take your calls on some of the biggest moments for you as we review politics and technology in the 2010s, next on Radio Boston. This is Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering. 50 years ago this year, there was a major highway expansion project in Greater Boston that got canceled after protests and community organizing. It was a six-lane highway. It would have torn through neighborhoods in Somerville, Cambridge, and Roxbury, basically a wall dividing vibrant communities. And one of the lead organizers who managed to stop it was Chuck Turner. He went on to serve in Boston City Council for five terms beginning in 1999. Turner died on Christmas at the age of 79. His legacy in the community is lasting. Here is his successor on the Boston City Council, former Councilor Tito Jackson, remembering Turner.
I want to see Chuck Turner remembered as the genius that he was. He was a great man and an even greater public servant, and we should understand that we owe him and the Turner family a debt of gratitude in many ways.
Joining us now to remember him and to explore Chuck Turner's legacy is Reverend Mariama White Hammond, pastor at the New Roots AME Church in Dorchester, and herself an activist and organizer. Welcome back to Radio Boston, Reverend Mariama.
Good to be with you.
Tell us who Chuck Turner was. What was he like?
Chuck was always working on behalf of folks. Like, I remember him from when I was a kid. My family, extended family, lived pretty close to where the highway was supposed to go, so I remember that fight. I went to his office as a constituent. I remember he'd hold these meetings. We had never had a council office before, and so he spent out of his own money to make sure that Roxbury had a council office, and he would often hold meetings there. I remember going to multiple meetings there on different topics. Chuck was always giving back.
Let's focus on that for a second, because he actually was the first councilor to put a councilor's office outside of City Hall in the district, right?
Yeah.
And was that sort of emblematic of who he was and how he engaged with his community?
I mean, the thing is, for many people, I remember going to meetings there with people who before that didn't really know what the city council did, right? And so he was constantly trying to bring people in, trying to make them aware of what government should be doing for them. Yeah, that's so much of his legacy, how much he mentored and supported and invited lots of folks into the process who otherwise wouldn't be there.
What did he think government should be doing for his community?
Well, a couple of things. First of all, Chuck was the most well-read, most on top of a person. When he introduced a topic, he knew it through and through. And he felt like it was really important that we had to know what was going on in our communities and really think creatively about how to address those issues. And then he was always trying to think about how we put the most vulnerable folks first, always thinking about the people who didn't already have jobs. He was always, always thinking about the folks that other people left out. And he thought that government should be about making a fairer playing ground and really lifting up those who are struggling rather than just always supporting the folks who are already doing well.
So, Reverend Mariamu, we have to address the fact that his time in government actually ended ultimately with a conviction in 2010 for attempted extortion and 3 counts of providing false statements to the FBI. He was removed from the Boston City Council, actually controversially before that conviction, ultimately won a lawsuit against the Boston City Council. How do we situate that chapter of Chuck Turner in his larger legacy?
Yeah, so I mean, I think, you know, talking about that case, there's a lot of emotion and a lot of feeling about why he was targeted and about what actually happened. I believe, as many people believe, that he may have made a mistake in sort of accepting money, but I don't believe that he was corrupt.
He was convicted of accepting $1,000 in cash in exchange for helping a nightclub win a liquor license. I just need to clarify
that. And I don't know what the man said to him, which, quite frankly, none of us know exactly what was said. What I do know is I knew him as a public servant. I knew him as a person who would give you the shirt off his back. I knew him as a person who stayed up late nights, showed up to places in the community that nobody else would go. I just know that he was a person who gave so much. So it's hard for me to square that with the way he was portrayed.
So let's talk about you coming up in your community. I've heard him talked about a number of times as somebody who raised a generation of activists and organizers. And you are an activist and an organizer. Is that a fair characterization of him? And were you heavily influenced in your own work by how Chuck Turner lived his life as an organizer?
Yes, I was. I think there are many of us who are. I routinely brought young people to meet with him because he was the kind of politician who would sit with them, who would explain to them, who didn't talk over their heads, and who would encourage them to be active. So yes, I benefited myself personally. I remember he would hire staff in his office, many of whom went on to be great organizers. He was constantly looking to develop and support younger activists. And this is not to knock other people. There are other people who are really helpful. I'm not sure I can name any person who's gone that far out of their way to consistently support new leaders.
What do you think are a couple of his biggest achievements? We already talked about his successful fight against the inner belt through Cambridge, Somerville, Roxbury, but what else?
I think he did a lot of work around organizing black workers, really pushing us to think about when things are being built in our community, are we asking questions about where those jobs are going and whether or not those jobs are supporting local folks. He was very active on education, on fighting for more money in the city budget for education. When I was working a lot around youth violence issues, he was a really strong supporter and one of those folks who was really actually willing to listen to young people who have been directly affected. So I could keep going on the number of things, at least that I know of personally, that I worked on, that he was a champion for in the city council.
Since he passed away on Wednesday night, social media has been full of people paying tribute to him and referring to him fairly consistently as both a great organizer and a complicated figure. How do you think Boston should remember Chuck Turner?
The reality is he was a guy who really believed that government should be for everyone, that power should be shared, and that the most vulnerable should be lifted up. For whatever flaws or mistakes he had as a human, no one can dispute that. And I think he taught a lot of us what it meant to be willing to fight, to be willing to sacrifice even personally to make sure that others were lifted up. I know there are always, people will mention all of the things that happened and some of the scandal, but for those of us who knew him and those of us who lived in a community that was consistently and often still is consistently overlooked and underserved, Chuck fought for our community. He fought for real people. And I hope many of us will continue that legacy and do the same at a time when that is needed more than ever as our neighborhoods are being gentrified and many of our folks are being pushed out. We all need to carry on his legacy, not just on Twitter, but at City Hall, in development meetings, in so many places where we need to stand up so that our communities are not erased.
Reverend Mariamu White Hammond is a pastor at the New Roots AME Church in Dorchester and an activist and organizer. Reverend Mariamu, thanks for being with us today.
Thank you.
And Chuck Turner's family released a statement this afternoon asking for privacy and saying that they'll soon release details of a memorial service for the community. Stay with us. After the break, we'll talk about politics over the last decade and take your calls. I'm Tisiana Deering. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Tisiana Deering, and it is Friday, and we are doing a decade in review for you today. In fact, two, but the first is politics.
We're thinking of having a Chicago Tea Party in July.
The radical left has got control of the process.
There's a Tea Party tidal wave.
I thank the people of Massachusetts for electing me as your next United States Senator. This is the people's seat.
I'm not recommending for every future president that they take a shellacking like I did last night.
10 months ago in Paris, I said before the world that we needed a strong global agreement to reduce carbon pollution and to set the world on a low carbon course. The result was the Paris Agreement.
Black lives matter! Black lives matter! Black lives matter!
The African American community is not just making this up. And it's not just something being politicized. It's real. And there's a history behind it. And we have to take it seriously.
Ladies and gentlemen, I am officially running for President of the United States. And we are going to make our country great again.
The American people are sick and tired of hearing about your damn emails.
Thank you. Me too.
It's just awfully good that someone with the temperament of Donald Trump is not in charge of the law in our country.
Because you'd be in jail.
Secretary Clinton.
The yeas are 230. The nays are 197. Present is one. Article 1 is adopted.
I'm exhausted just listening to that, and it barely scratches the surface of politics in the last decade. But we've got some help to help us make sense of it. So joining me here in Studio 3 is Boston Globe political reporter James Pindle. James, welcome back to Radio Boston.
Thanks for having me.
Also on the line with us from Washington is WBUR senior news correspondent Kimberly Atkins. Welcome back, Kimberly.
Hi, Tiziana.
And we have you. Join us. What were your biggest political moments of the last 10 years? Have your politics changed? How? And for better or for worse since 2010? Call us. 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. All right, James and Kimberly, I'm going to ask you the same first question that I've asked on the other decades in review we've done over the last couple of weeks. James, I'll start with you. If there were a through line, if you were going to pick a through line or a thematic line for the last decade in U.S. politics, what would it be?
It was dark.
All right.
It's probably the darkest decade we've had in politics since the 1960s. If you think about it, you know, people who just became early adults this past decade, say they're 20 to they're 25, this is all they've known. This was a decade of controversy, of gridlock, of outrage, and of the politics of resentment. And what was interesting about the montage you had, I think it's fitting. We began the decade with the rise of the Tea Party. We ended it with an impeachment of a president. We didn't talk necessarily about the things we wanted to do together as a country. We talked constantly about things that we were opposing the other side on, whether it was Merrick Garland in the Supreme Court. This is the decade of Trayvon Martin and Black Lives Matter. I think you heard the president talk about that. Massive shootings. Nothing happened with that. Climate change. No real movement since we got out of the Paris Accord agreement. Government shutdowns throughout the entire process. And every single time a politician had a choice, they always picked the more populist and the more base-driven politics because that was the part of the incentives in the system. Now, locally, and then we can move on, but locally it was a period in New England and particularly of Massachusetts of transition, particularly generational change. I mean, the Scott Brown election clearly was a very, very big moment.
The first time
a Republican had been elected to the Senate since 1972 from this state. Clearly, his reelection led to the rise of Elizabeth Warren, who's obviously been one of the biggest stars. And then now we've seen this entire culture where you don't challenge the old guard. You wait your turn in Massachusetts politics. You play the long game. Also, the script has been totally flipped, where now every single member of Congress faces a primary, except for Ayanna Pressley. Except for Ayanna Pressley, which is amazing. And then obviously we have a Senate primary the same way. So it's a period of transition for locally, but
I want to
nationwide, it's been very dark.
I want to get Kimberly in on this, especially Kimberly. Would you paint the same picture?
Yeah, I think what I would have said, partisanship has been the through line. And in all of the clips that you played and in all of the, not just the political fights, but the societal fights that we've talked about, things like Black Lives Matter, climate change, they've all been fought in an arena that included partisanship. You can tell which side, for the most part, that people were on based on the political party or the political ideology that they subscribed to. Everything, things that used to be bipartisan, things that used to form consensus, down, you know, things like Supreme Court justice picks, you know, the some of the most ideologically different Supreme Court justices in recent history, Ruth Bader Ginsburg and Antonin Scalia, were confirmed by unanimous or near unanimous votes. That will never happen again. In fact,
Do you really believe that, Kimberly?
I do.
It will never happen again.
Not in at least a generation. Not unless things fundamentally change here in Washington in a way that I can't foresee it happening at all. And so now you have these partisan fights over everything, gun control, despite the fact that we have seen so much gun violence in the last decade, an unspeakable amount that is caught up in partisan gridlock. Black Lives Matter, the women's movement, climate change, everything that you can think of is really sends people to their corners, right down to this impeachment. If you recall, with Nixon, the reason he resigned is because Republicans went to him, Republicans in the Senate went to him after the tapes were revealed and said, look, you don't have enough support within your own party. This is over. Could you imagine that happening now? The Republicans have been so solidly behind President Trump, regardless what the facts show. So I think that's been the through line so far.
1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK to join the conversation and do. These are stark pictures that James and Kimberly have painted. Is it the picture you would paint? What's the through line that you see in the decade in politics over the last 10 years? Give us a call here at Radio Boston. There are so many themes that the two of you hit in those opening threads. One of them that you didn't, that I thought was an interesting bracketing, was healthcare. I mean, as we went into the decade, we saw the Affordable Care Act had been passed. And then we heard President Obama talk about his shellacking in the midterm elections after that. Part of the reason that we had a shellacking of the Republicans in the 2018 midterm elections was an attempt to roll it back. But now we've got a lot of people watching Democrats who may want to vote Democrat saying, you go too far on Medicare for all, we're going to have a problem there, too. So how does it... Is healthcare a bug or a feature of the last 10 years, James?
That's a great question. You know, what's fascinating about it, you're right on the bookends. But what has been true throughout is that any time a party tries to even do something with healthcare, either offer a new program like the Affordable Care Act or take it away, that is the party that gets shellacked. The status quo is the one who always wins when it comes to healthcare. But you're right. This is the decade where healthcare remains today to be the number one issue when you ask in polling what voters care about. The beginning of the decade was largely about the economy and healthcare coming out, of course, the Great Recession. But that has been a through line in American politics as long in this decade, as well as immigration, which has almost been much more of a social issue than it has been any other thing.
So, Kimberly, you've been covering Washington for a while. I want to play a little bit of sound. This is during the GOP repeal and replace effort. July 2017, people are waiting on the floor to see what John McCain's going to do. Mitch McConnell's looking on with his arms crossed. And here's McCain giving the thumbs down.
Mr. Peters.
You know, it strikes me as I was thinking about this decade, Kimberly, that John McCain is an interesting figure who also has his own kind of through line. His voice is not one I feel like we hear someone else picking up today. Is his kind of presence missed, appropriately missed, needed?
Yeah, I mean, look, his absence is definitely palpable on the Senate side in Capitol Hill. But at the same time, look, John McCain was someone, if you recall, way, way back to the presidential election, the campaign election of 2008 and after that. John McCain was a vocal opponent of Barack Obama. You know, there was plenty of partisanship that was happening there. But the difference was it wasn't at all costs. You remember, recall during that campaign when John McCain shut down a supporter who wanted to question the patriotism and Americanness of Barack Obama. There were some lines that he would not cross in a way that now it feels like there is no line that can't be crossed in the interest of partisanship. And certainly John McCain was somebody who was willing to stand up with his words, but also his votes, as is in that case with the effort to repeal Obamacare, stand up to Donald Trump in a way that few Republicans do now. So in that sense, yes, that is definitely something that increases to that exists to a much lesser extent. We'll see during this impeachment hearing if there are Republicans willing to buck their party, but it seems that that's unlikely.
1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK if you want to join the conversation. Galen, pull up a seat at the table. You're calling from Cambridge. What's on your mind?
Thanks so much for taking my call.
Absolutely.
I really appreciate it. And thanks for your great program all year. So I'm 26, and the past decade has been the one that I consider the time when I really came of political age, if you will. In 2010, I was I was in my junior year of high school and wasn't really paying attention to the news. Took most things for granted. My parents had a paper on the table every morning, and if I flipped to a page, it was most often like the sports section or something. And around 2014, I was in southern New Hampshire, and I remember seeing a Scott Brown campaign bus for some odd reason, maybe supporting the local Republican person running against, I think it was Gene Shaheen at the time. And I started to pay a little bit more attention, but was still really pretty dialed out. And then 2015, 2016, the current president announced his election, I again took it for granted, perhaps like a lot of pundits. And then he was elected. And I decided I was going to major in history, American history. I wanted to see how much things had changed, whereas previously in high school I took little interest in history. I started to read the paper every day, and I still do, and not because I want to.
And is there one big issue now, Galen, as you've had that awakening? Is there one big issue that weighs most heavily on you?
Yes.
Which is
my great-grandparents came from Europe. It's immigration.
There we go.
And my senior year of high school or college, a kid who I was in school with for all my years there, he said to me, like, I don't know what I'm going to do after graduation. I'm undocumented.
Let's take it from there, Galen. I appreciate you introducing immigration into this conversation. It is important. And I want to pick up on Galen's timeline. This sound you're going to think is from later than it is. This is Donald J. Trump.
Donald J. Trump is calling for a total and complete shutdown of Muslims entering the United States until our country's representatives can figure out what the hell is going on.
Now, the Muslim ban actually was put in place for the first time in January of 2017, but that's December 25th. James, you knew. So
yeah.
Pick up from there.
No, I mean, I remember the moment I was leaving work, and it was even the newsroom at the Globe when the email came out. It was, I can't remember, it was the first week of December of early 2015. Again, I think you're smart for picking up on healthcare. Now that I think about it more, I'm going to come back to this point, which is healthcare kind of gave us our biggest moments in politics, defined elections, defined, you know, a lot of the decade. The other through thread when you're talking about John McCain, and it's going to get to this immigration point, which is the other thing we saw in this decade was a total collapse of the Christian right and the Republican Party. I am, as a person who covers politics, endlessly fascinated with what happens with the Republican Party after Donald Trump. Right now, it doesn't have an identity. It is the Trump Party, and is driven entirely about him. And moments like that really captured this politics of grievance and how important immigration was going to play, particularly in a Republican a primary base. That seemed to be a shocking moment of a lot of shocking moments. Remember, that was a moment when he came out with that night. every single Republican running against him when there were 17 other, or 16 others, or 17 running, were all opposing. Every single Democrat were all opposing. People calling it un-American. This is Republicans. And now it is really, it's a party which is driven entirely about one person and not necessarily about particular ideology. And I think that was a particular moment when you begin to see this moving. Remember, this is Trump is winning in the polls at this point, and we see him possibly winning Iowa and New Hampshire. He doesn't do that. He wins just New Hampshire. But this is a very serious moment.
Kimberly, should people have understood? You know, we've heard so many times over the years the difference between people who take Donald Trump literally but not seriously and those who take him seriously but not literally. What was that moment?
That moment was one of many that shows that all along Americans should have taken Donald Trump both seriously and literally, because this is something that he carried out. This was still when he was calling for this. This was still during a period of time that folks like James and me were being told by Republicans that, you know, this is campaign rhetoric. You know, once if he gets into office, then the seriousness of the office will take hold and he will modify. There has been no modification. He tried and the courts kept sending him back. He tried and succeeded in imposing a ban, not as sweeping as the one he wanted, because there are limits imposed by the Constitution. But he did instill the ban. He's trying as hard as he can to build the wall. He is trying to act on every bit of fear-oriented immigration policy that he campaigned on and that his core supporters want. And this is just one of many areas. There are a few things that Donald Trump campaigned on that he has not at least tried with all his might to make policy in office.
All right. Our lines are filling up and our time is getting short. So I'm going to try to grab two quick calls here. First, we've got Sherry in Fitchburg. Sherry, go ahead.
Hi.
Hi.
I can't help but have to call, and I feel compelled to share what to me and a lot of women is the biggest issue that we have right now. And that is that this entire presidency, both in the candidacy stage, post-election, Brett Kavanaugh, you have millions and millions of women like myself across the country who have been triggered, had to go back into therapy and seek professional help just to get through day to day. And it leaves us all with a feeling like we are completely helpless. So we get out, we march, but still nothing changes.
Sherry, when you talk about triggering, you mean triggered about sexual assault, violence towards women, those kinds of things? I just want to make sure I'm understanding you.
Sexual assault in particular, yes.
Okay. I'm sorry you're having that experience, too. Sherry, I want to get Debbie's call in as well, and then I want to give our panel a chance to answer. You raise a very important point and a sense of solidarity with other women who are having a similar experience. Debbie from Revere, let's get you on the line, too. Go ahead.
Hi. I just feel like I hear less and less about our country being founded on the separation of church and state, and there's just been this warping of freedom of religion being used as a weapon against other people. And I don't hear anybody talking about separation of church and state anymore. And that really bothers me.
I appreciate you raising that, Debbie. And, you know, James, you did make mention of sort of the change of the role of the religious right over the last 10 years. I do want to do these in sequence. I want to make sure that we respect what Sherry had to say. Kimberly, comments on Sherry's point first, and then James, I'll come to you about Debbie.
Yeah, I mean, recall right after Donald Trump was inaugurated, the biggest protests in Washington, D.C. and around the world took place. The Women's March that was talking about these very issues. It was after the Access Hollywood comments the president made. Of course, Brett Kavanaugh's confirmation brought that to the fore. We did see a record number of women elected to Congress and to offices, state and local offices around the country. So there has been a political reaction to this. There's also been lots of legislation passed aimed at addressing sexual harassment and violence against women. They are sitting in the House. They will not likely get action in the Senate anytime soon. So there has been some action, despite the flurry of news that keeps it from coming to the fore in that way. And, you know, the same thing we've seen an increase in attempts by this administration to make it harder, easier for people to discriminate against folks on the basis of religion. So that is also an issue. It's hard for all of them to break
Although
through the headlines
every day.
Although
I do think the administration would frame it as allowing people freedom of religious conscience. And the reason I bring that up is because we're about to go to the church and state question with James. So James, let me throw to you there.
Well, first, I mean, I have a note here on my phone for my notes for the show. This is clearly the also the decade of the Me Too movement. Obviously, underlying a lot of this conversation, which is different than obviously different than where I'm about to head here, which is while there's been a decline on the Christian right in terms of a political force. Obviously, the gay marriage happened this decade in terms of a Supreme Court hearing. One of the other big through lines has been the real collapse of pro-choice abortion movement. The idea that Kavanaugh is on the court and now giving that fifth vote whenever that wants to happen to overturn Roe v. Wade has been a very big moment. And this is something that's happened through every single Supreme Court pick this past decade. You can see that happening and playing out. I'd say overall, in terms of separation between church and state, it's a great point. Where it is not getting enough conversation, obviously, when it comes to things like the Muslim ban. But where I think it's interesting is that how the relationship between the Christian right and Donald Trump, particularly leaders of that Christian right, is one of the most fascinating relationships we've seen. Clearly, he is not holding up the values that they have argued so long that they claimed that they wanted. But he's a very, very important part of his coalition.
And really specifically the white evangelical
absolutely
vote in this case. Yeah. All right, with the last 30 seconds or so, Kimberly, I'll come to you first. What's next? What's the next big theme that you think is coming?
I think it depends a lot on the outcome of the 2020 election, of course, and also the outcome, what happens in the end of this impeachment. If Donald Trump is reelected, he becomes the first president to be reelected after being impeached. And I think we will see him completely untethered in terms of what could happen. So I think that would dramatically change the political landscape.
And James?
One thing we aren't talking about enough this decade is we are in the middle of a political transformation in the country. It happens every 40 years, and we are in the middle of one right now. I talk about the collapse of the Republican Party. The Democrats have collapsed as well. They just had a Democratic president through much of this last decade, and they're now reckoning with it. We entered the decade with two political parties. Now we have four. There's left, right, and up and down. And how that plays out in the next decade, I think, is going to be absolutely fascinating.
Boston Globe political reporter James Pindle, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Kimberly Atkins, WBUR senior news correspondent, thanks.
Thank you.
Stay with us. I'm Tisiana Deering. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Tisiana Deering. We are going to continue our decade in review. We're going to turn our attention to tech now.
Everybody uses a laptop and/or a smartphone. And the question has arisen, is there room for a third category of device in the middle? We think we've got something that is. And we call it the iPad.
Pretty neat because it knows all sorts of things. All you have to do is ask.
Alexa, how tall is Mount Everest?
Mount Everest's height is 29,029 feet, 8,800.
Zuckerberg, would you be comfortable sharing with us the name of the hotel you stayed in last night?
No.
I think that might be what this is all about. Your right to privacy and how much you give away in modern America.
Another breathtaking decade of change. We have a lot to cover, but we have help. First in here in Studio 3 is Hiawatha Bray, technology writer for the Boston Globe. Hiawatha, welcome.
Hey, glad to be here.
Also here with us in Studio 3 is Judith Doneth. Judith Doneth, an advisor at Harvard's Berkman Klein Center and the author of The Social Machine. Judith, welcome.
Hello.
And you're here to help us reflect, too. How do you reflect on the technological changes of the past decade? How has your life changed? And even as I'm asking that question, I'm thinking, is there any way in which your life hasn't changed as a result of tech in the last decade? Call us. Join the conversation. 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. You know, there's a really interesting through line from the previous segment and some of what emerged in the decade in politics that I think we're going to find connects tightly to some of what mm-hmm. we're going to talk about here. But I want to start with this idea of throughline as we've done our various subjects, social movements, religion, politics. I've asked every time, and Hiawatha, I'll start with you. If you were going to pick a throughline theme for the last decade in tech, what would it be?
I guess I would have to go with the word big.
Big.
Big. That what we're really seeing here is the unification of a bunch of stuff that's happening and its expansion to fill pretty much all the void of our technological lives, starting with the fact, everybody, it's so easy to forget this, but 10 years ago, what we now think of as broadband would have seemed almost unimaginably advanced, because the average person in his home was getting maybe about 3 megabits. And now the average home that has broadband is getting something like 90 megabits. It's an astonishing growth. And that explosion of bandwidth was largely driven by Google, which entered the market and said, we're going to put really, really fast internet into cities all over America. They didn't follow through completely, but the sheer presence of their being there causes this flood of new broadband to major American cities so that you suddenly start getting fast internet. On top of that, you got 4G. So you've got mobile fast internet.
And now we've got 5G coming.
Yeah, and we've got 5G coming. And I think almost everything that has happened has grown out of the ever-present availability of reasonably fast internet, which just causes this explosion of innovation and also an explosion of some other things that aren't so good.
So, Judith, that's so interesting, because if you had said to me, what's the big thing I think we're going to talk about? The internet feels like 10 years before, but Hiawatha makes such a case there. What's your through line for the last decade?
I would say it's social, that as human beings, we're very social creatures. We're super aware of what other people think about us and what we think of them and how we make sense of them. And the technologies we've been seeing are really changing how we see other people, how much they see of us. You know, even if we look at things like, and it's not even clear whether they're making us more or less social. Mm-hmm. If you look at particularly how teenagers live today, their lives, while they may not see each other face to face as often, are completely permeated with sending pictures and being aware and knowing what hundreds of their peers are doing at every moment. So it's both more and less social. And we're also seeing all these, like, even as we look at things like surveillance technologies, are changing how social we are, because the ways in which we used to have to depend on other people for information about, like, who's trustworthy. You know, there's things like Airbnb grew out of couch surfing. And now,
which is a very intimate and personal way
exactly.
to travel.
Right. You had to, and you also had to present yourself as someone who could be trusted. You had to really suss out who else was trustworthy, make all these connections. Then they made it a little bit more efficient with an app that helped you know a little bit better who might also be in Goa or wherever you were hanging out. And then that eventually turned into something like Airbnb, where you don't need any kind of social connection at all. We've replaced that social component with a form of surveillance. Mm-hmm. So it's, I think it's been a decade of massive transformation in what it means to be social.
1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Join the conversation. We're kind of old school social with the call in, but I still love it, and it keeps mm-hmm. us connected. So join the conversation. Hiawatha, when I asked the politics panel at the beginning of the last segment, what's the through line, James Pindle said dark. And as I was listening to the two of you and some of that montage at the beginning, I had a sneaking feeling that maybe there's a dark arc to tech in the last 10 years. Am I just being grumpy or?
Yes, you are. But you're still but you're still right. It's so annoying because so much of what has happened has been marvelous and magnificent and wonderful. But it has also raised all kinds of interesting issues, ranging from the slightly troubling to the hugely troubling. One of the, I'll give you an example of the slightly troubling thing. It just occurred to me. In 1964, the Beatles appeared on national TV and 40% of the U.S. public watched it. Back then, we had this thing called mass media, and we had a shared culture of shared experience. Largely thanks to the internet, that's dead. We are becoming a society of little segments and units. And this is obviously reflected in our politics, in the way
there's
we deal with religion,
yeah.
in the way we do with everything else. Because we are now a society in which if you are interested in a particular little niche thing, you can find it on the internet, you can find a TV show devoted to it on Netflix, you can find music devoted to it on Spotify, and you don't have to have anything to do with anybody else who's not into that thing. That's a world that is almost new to us, although in fact, that's actually the way the world used to be. The mass media thing is relatively new. It starts in the 30s, it ends in the 80s, and now we're back to the way it used to be for most of history, where everybody's off in their own little corner. And that's not necessarily a good thing. The other dark thing, of course, is the very thing you were talking about. Surveillance, almost by accident. What really happens is that the computers, the memory, and the sensors, thanks to Moore's Law, get dirt cheap.
Wait, what's Moore's Law?
The law that says that electronic components based on transistors are going to double the number of transistors on a chip every 18 months, and so things get faster, more powerful, and cheaper. It's just about run out now, but it's too late for us because all these devices are now so insanely cheap. Cameras, microphones, memory, GPS chips, and we started putting them in all these devices for perfectly innocent reasons. And then one day they looked up and said, hey, if you've got all these things in devices, we can track everything everybody's doing. And now they're starting to do that. And yeah, that's scary.
Listeners, are you worried about that? I do think about that. I do worry about that. And Judith, 1984, the book, I never thought that he imagined that the way we would wind up in a surveillance state was voluntarily as a result of wanting convenience.
It's yeah, and it's not just wanting convenience. And I think there's ways of taking that same history that Hiawatha just shared with us and looking at it a little differently, because in the early days of the internet, it looked like a great thing that you wouldn't have to rely on mass media for all your information, because the downside of it is you have in many countries just completely government-controlled media.
Or implicit bias about
exactly
what kind of information comes forward.
So a lot of this was great. People could publish. You would have a lot more sources. It was wonderful. One of the things people didn't foresee was that the internet would become so dependent on advertising. So the surveillance comes from two directions. Some of it is government surveillance, and some of it is corporate surveillance.
I think most of it right now is
right
corporate
now.
Surveillance.
Is that
yes.
fair?
The great bulk of it, yes.
Certainly here.
Mm-hmm.
And
in China, you might see
here in the U.S.?
Yes, in
the
China,
US,
you
right.
might
in China.
Describe it a little differently.
Yeah.
But it's the same technologies. And I think what we're seeing when you mention dark and politics, part of what's dark is that the technologies that make us think, well, okay, so we give up this privacy, it's for advertising, could switch very quickly to being a government surveillance system that was a lot more sinister.
Well, that's
what's
so scary, because we agreed to all this stuff. Remember? Don't you remember when this first starts? Like, with Google was, well, they're only doing it to send us more interesting ads. And that's what we thought it was all for. And it was at the time. I think what really happened was that little by little, the people who designed these systems realized, oh, but you could use it to do this. And you could also use it to do this. And you could also use it to do this. Put GPS in the phone and we don't have to pay for GPS. Remember? You have to buy a GPS unit.
That's right.
Now it's free.
And pay a subscription.
There you go. And now we find out that it's free, but it means that Google knows where we are every minute of the day.
Is there any way, Hiawatha, to unsign up for that now?
Well, yeah, of course. You don't have to use those things. If you want to live that way, you can. The problem is nobody wants to live that way.
Well, are we and this is a genuine question. Are we reaching a point where it will not be possible to choose not to live that way? I think about how hard it would be to live off the grid now.
Well, I think a more practical and useful way to look at it is to say that that's some of what we need more activism over, is that we should be able to have GPS and we should be able to have online discussions and all these technologies, but not have them all be free and ad-supported. And it's more of a question of understanding the psychology that's made it so difficult to have these as paid services, because there really is no free lunch or beer or any of the other metaphors people use.
What do they say? If it's free, you're the product?
Exactly.
Or something like that?
And so I think one of the important technologies I would like to see in the next decade is for people to finally understand the not just the technology, but the marketing and the psychology to make it so that people will actually pay for things like the news and Google and not have it sort of secretly paid for through advertising. But I don't think we should have to live off the grid in order to not be surveyed.
1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. We have Risk, I think, is the name out of Lawrence. Go ahead.
That is correct. The name is Risk.
Hi, Risk.
I actually...
That is a cool name, by the way.
Thank you very much. My little brother got the name Dylan, so I kind of got unlucky there. So you guys at the beginning of this had all mentioned, you know, one word about big tech, and I would say indefinitely control is one word I'd put in there. Control because of, and to play off something else that was said, ad tracking. And overall tracking as well. Even going, you know, I tend to use Android phones. Android is owned by the company Google. Not a lot of people put the two together. Most people just call them Samsungs. But they do track everything you do. And I own Androids and I swear by them. And I haven't used Google in probably 2 years. And, you know, I love it. It's, you know, it's a really important thing to me. It's just data, is being secure with your data and private with your data.
So I want to pick up there.
That's not something you see anymore.
Yeah, Risk, I want to pick up there, and you can stay on the line. So Risk is both talking about control, but also data. And Hiawatha, I know that's something that you've thought about. What's your reaction to what risk is?
Well, see, I can just tell you my own experience, and shame on me, I guess, if you're hyper concerned about privacy, because I'm in the middle of this. And here's what's so weird about it. I don't want to stop a lot of what I do in terms of using Google. For example, Google does have a knowledge of where I am, and it shares that knowledge with me. I can go onto my Google dashboard and see every place I've been for years because I've got an Android phone in my pocket. I actually like that.
Risk,
I think it's very beneficial.
And Risk, how do you feel about that? Hiawatha likes it. Do you like it?
You actually picked me on a very good opinion here. I'm a truck driver, and I turned that feature off a couple of years ago. And I, when you say things like that, and, you know, I preach this to my friends. I'm all about open source software and, you know, technology that does not track and does not watch you. And my friends, you know, and everyone else I know, they all say the same thing. And that's, you know, I don't mind the convenience of it. I don't mind, you know, I have nothing to hide from anybody. So why would I care? You know, why do I care that Google knows where I am? And I got to say, you know, you do have everything to lose there. You know, if you're, for instance, you know, so let's say you're.
Actually, Risk, I'm sorry, I got to stop you there because I want to be able to get another call in a minute. And I want to give Judith a chance to react to what you just said. Thank you so much for the call. Judith, go ahead.
I think some of it is people have different scenarios when they think about what the now that I have the risk word in mind, what the concern is about this, because at the sort of darkest edge is the fear of a totalitarian government that's going to go after you for something that you have done. In some ways, I think that may be the least concern, simply because if you have such danger, we've had that kind of situation before, long before there was big data. The other, I think the ad side is the kind of new futuristic problem, because what we're not seeing quite yet, and I think we will be seeing a lot more in the next decade, is the much more sophisticated control of people's behavior, especially when we start.
You're freaking me out.
Dealing with things like Alexa and Siri, when you start having personal relationships with these creatures, like look at who owns Alexa. This is a company that wants you to buy things, and it starts to know more about your habits and what mood you're in, and starts to feel a little disappointed when you don't do what it asked for,
and be able to make you feel guilty. Exactly right.
Go ahead. I just want to remember this.
A few years back, Facebook caused a firestorm of controversy when they told the world this like it was the most perfectly innocent thing in the world. They said, well, we were working with some scientists and we experimented with posting different things on people's news feeds to see if we could change their emotional responses. And we found evidence that based on what we show them on Facebook, we could make people feel more or less depressed. And they were shocked that people were horrified by that. But they had just revealed that one of the real dangers here. When you have a company like a Facebook or a Google that knows that much about us, they are in a position to actually change the way we think without us even realizing that they're doing it.
So
that's really scary.
So what has to change so that we get to the point that it is not shocking to an executive of a company like that, that people would be upset to find out you were trying to manipulate whether or not a user would get depressed?
Okay, I'm going to come out in Facebook's defense here, just on that particular study.
Right.
Because I could see why they were surprised, because, you know, you said you like our mass media, but every single TV show does that. If you do, like, all those focus groups that look at movies and says, what ending should we put in here?
Or but when not for news.
Exactly. So the issue was with Facebook was it... I think what they thought they were doing was similar to that. They were playing around with what sort of things they put in the feed. And what they didn't recognize was people, I think it wasn't so much just the manipulation of emotion, but that they're also manipulating your entire understanding of your social landscape. I think people were not as aware how limited the view they're seeing is and how much it's being controlled. It could be controlled to make you happier. It could be controlled just to, I think sometimes it's controlled to diffuse arguments, all kinds of
things. And they have said, Facebook has openly said, we're going to start doing that. We're going to try to make, even after this, they've said, we're going to change the way we present the world to you to make people less, you know, angry with each other, to present a friendlier face to the world. Who gave them that job? That's really scary, even if they're doing it for good intentions. We are putting them, we're giving them the ability to manipulate the way we think and the way we feel in ways that really make me nervous. I don't mind Google knowing where I am so much, but I mind them trying to change the way I feel or what I know.
We've got 30 seconds. Next big trend, Hiawatha.
Next big trend. I'm not really sure because I think what we're going to see, well, the biggest thing right now in the offing is 5G. There's no question about that. 5G allowing for things like much faster communications between digital devices so that we can get even smarter devices because much of the computing won't even be in the little device. It'll be out in the cloud.
Amazing.
And it will be really much more powerful.
And Judith?
Ideally, the next one would be people having more control over their data and diminished power of advertising would be the ideal.
All right. Judith Doneth, author of The Social Machine and advisor at Harvard's Berkman Klein Center, thank you.
Thank you.
And Hiawatha Bray, tech writer for the Boston Globe, thanks so much.
Lots of fun.
That is our show for today. Radio Boston is a production of 90.9 WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. I'm Tiziana Deering. Join us again on Monday for more Radio Boston.